Okay, so in honor of this occasion, I decided I had to do something special. So I've made a new translation of one of the great works of world literature and commissioned two of the most famous artists of the 20th century to illustrate the new translation. And in the course of this translation, I reveal deep connections to modern string theory physics. And I tried to preserve a certain amount of the archaic flavor of the original, as you can see here. But you will, when I get to the physics, I'll go into more modern language. So those of you who can read Italian will see that because of all of my efforts, the English loses a certain amount in translation. So I hope you know, now all know what ITP means. So let me begin. In the middle of his life, D.G. ITP found himself in a dark wood of error, surrounded by a claque of courtiers who whispered seductive stories of fabulous monsters in his ear. Il Leopardo de string field theory. La chimera de background independence. Now, at this point, you have to imagine David speaking. Avaunt, ye rascals, quoth DG. Simplicity lies at high energy. Know ye not the wisdom of the great sage Feynman? Here's the gospel according to Feynman. In quantum mechanics, e to the iht for short times can be approximated by e to the minus iht zero times e to the itv. And h0 is Gaussian and dominates the short time propagation. And all of the simplicity of classical mechanics and path integrals depends on constructing our Hilbert space in terms of those Gaussian variables. And so we should be trying to follow that pattern. DG continued, more generally, as taught by the Holy Wilson, high energy is dominated by a fixed point whose simple beauty is revealed by scattering at large invariants. Long ago, I revealed to you the doctrine of asymptotic freedom and shed light on the darkness in the heart of the hadron. Let us do the same for quantum gravity. And so, with his mendicant squire, the bold DG calculated the hard scattering S matrix in perturbative string theory. But for once, DG set his sights too low. In the dark wood of error, the string scale was oft confused with the Planck scale. And in the true heart of the world lay a black pit. Now, what I mean by that is that if one thinks about scattering theory in quantum gravity, thinks about energies much, much larger than the Planck scale, scattering is dominated at most impact parameters, at a set of impact parameters that grow with the energy like a power. Scattering is dominated by black hole production and decay. So you try to calculate what's going on at short distances by doing large momentum transfer scattering, but you find that most of the cross section goes into creating black holes. Furthermore, the black holes decay in a way that Stephen Hawking taught us about many, many years ago, and they decay thermally with a temperature that goes to zero as their mass goes to infinity. And that means that the details of the final states in black hole scattering are actually sensitive to the structure of your low energy vacuum, because the very low temperature final states will depend on which massless particles and so on you have in the theory. So are we to abandon all hope of universality? I'd want to point out before addressing that question that what happens in black hole scattering is actually very similar, at least in qualitative ways, to what was found by Gross and Mende in their perturbative string theory calculation. Exclusive processes with large momentum transfer and small numbers of particles go to zero very rapidly. The big cross sections are all dominated by making one large thing, which then decays into low energy stuff. So I'd like to proceed on. At this point, you should think of me, those of you who know the original poem, you should think of me as Virgil, the symbol of reason, who leads the soul of DG through the darkness of the inferno and purgatory into the gates of paradise. So here we go down into the darkness. Black holes pose a lot of problems for this idea of background independence that Steve so eloquently presented to us in the previous talk. First of all, by thinking about black holes, you very quickly come to the conclusion that in any theory of quantum gravity in asymptotically flat space, the high energy density of states is dominated by black hole states. They're almost stable, and the high energy density of states is different when the number of non-compact asymptotically flat dimensions is different. Usually we think of different backgrounds as different solutions to the same theory that come from the same fixed point and have the same high energy density of states. Furthermore, as I'll review in a moment, in asymptotically flat M theory, this high energy density of states suggests that conventional quantum mechanics, where you can look at the time-dependent matrix elements of a very large class of operators, will fail except in light cone gauge. But in light cone gauge, going to a different vacuum state always means going to a different Hamiltonian. And so the problem of background independence becomes, and what that could possibly mean, becomes very puzzling. Finally, high energy short distance physics, as I said to you a moment ago, is dominated by black hole production, and the final states, as I've said, are vacuum dependent. And in a similar vein, if you try to use another field theory trick for seeing that there are several different vacua in the same theory, namely, you have some discrete isolated vacuum states of a field theory, and you create bubbles in which inside a very large bubble there is one vacuum state, and then asymptotically outside there's another. As I showed in a recent paper, that fails in quantum gravity in a fairly general way, again, because what you do when you try to create such a bubble is instead to create a black hole, and that black hole decays back into the vacuum out, the excitations of the vacuum out at infinity. And so again, you fail to find other vacua, at least if they're not on the same moduli specs. So I'm going to propose to you a cure, or a direction to go in more precisely for all of these problems. I like to call this asymptotic darkness. The idea that what we maybe should be doing in thinking about a theory of gravity is thinking of black holes as the partons, thinking of the theory of the very high energy density of states as the fixed point theory that maybe is exactly soluble, and then from it we have a problem of constructing the map between the high energy degrees of freedom and the low energy degrees of freedom. So let me try to explain to you how I think that might work a little bit. First of all, the claim that I made previously about quantum mechanics, if I look at the two-point function of a generic operator in a quantum mechanical theory, you can write it as an integral over a density of states. And the point about black hole densities of states is that they always grow with the energy, with a power of the energy greater than one. So that the standard Euclidean damping of the high energy spectrum doesn't work in a theory of quantum gravity. And so unless you have a very special set of operators which are set up not to measure what's going on at high energy, whose matrix elements at very high energy states go to zero very rapidly, the two-point functions won't be well defined. Well, there's one way out of this problem. If you really wanted to go to very high energy and you wanted to have well-defined two-point functions, you would be fine if you had operators A that could resolve the degeneracy of black hole states, that A coupled the vacuum only to a few of the many black hole states of a given energy. And so that suggests that the way to define the quantum mechanics of a theory of quantum gravity is to understand the spectrum of states of very, very large black holes, find an organizing principle so that we can construct operators which couple only to a few of those states. Now, you may think it funny to think about black holes as partons. Partons in QCD are thought of as point-like objects. But in fact, black holes are, if you go to very high energy, the most point-like objects you can have. The way I like to think about this was taught to me by Lubos Motl. I call it Motl's holographic uncertainty relation, and it's a bit of a hand wave. You start from the holographic principle, namely areas or entropy. So you shouldn't have an area smaller than one bit. So you get a sort of bound on products of x coordinates to the d minus 2 have to be greater than something of order the Planck scale to the d minus 2. Now, apply this to the case where one of the delta x's is in a time-like direction, the others are space-like, and then use the fact that we have a standard time-energy uncertainty relation so that if I have a state with energies of order E, I can resolve times delta T, which are of order 1 over E. Then you get a spatial uncertainty relation for things that have energy E, which says that delta X to the D minus 3 is greater than E times L Planck to the D minus 2. And those of you who know about black holes will recognize this as the statement that the size of an object of energy E has to be greater than the Schwarzschild radius of a black hole of energy E. So black holes may be big and fat and non-point-like, but if you're trying to study high-energy physics, they're as point-like as you can get. Now, another thing that black holes share with partons is that there's a certain sense in which black holes become a completely trivial soluble system as the mass goes to infinity. Namely, we know what the spectrum of black holes is. For every m, there are black holes sufficiently large, there are black holes of mass m, and we know the spectral degeneracy of the level m. So in the sense of writing down the Hamiltonian, we can write down a formula for the spectrum of the quantum mechanical Hamiltonian, which would be essentially exact, except for the fact that black holes are not really stable excitations of the theory. But as m goes to infinity, that goes away. So, because the Hawking temperature goes to zero as m goes to infinity. So there's a certain sense in which, just like the free partons of QCD, we should think of black holes as stable, high-energy excitations of the system. So we know the high-energy spectrum exactly, and the hard part of the problem from this point of view is like the problem of hadronization in QCD scattering. We have to understand the relationship between the black hole states, which have a very simple description in terms of the Hamiltonian, and the states that we know and love at low energy. I call this the problem of gravitonization, in analogy with hadronization. How do we relate the black holes, the partons, to the low energy spectrum of QCD? Note again that like the quarks and gluons in QCD, black holes enable us to compute certain high energy inclusive cross sections. Actually, that was what we learned from Stephen Hawking, thinking about the fact that black holes dominate high energy scattering. We can then calculate the inclusive probabilities for various final states just by using the Hawking radiation formula for a black hole of very large mass, and that formula should become more and more accurate as the mass goes to infinity. So that's a sort of asymptotic expansion of high energy processes that we know how to do. There are no black holes in the final state, just as there are no partons in the final state in QCD. Obviously, you shouldn't push the analogy too far. There's no string between a pair of black holes that prevents them from getting out. They decay, rather, in a different way. But the main point of my discussion this morning is just to suggest to you that we've always found that the way to think about quantum mechanical theories, the way to set up their Hamiltonian, was to go and think about the very high energy behavior of the theory, find a simple solution of the very high energy, and then treat everything else as a small perturbation of that. That's the message of the Feynman path integral. We write down, or of Schrodinger quantum mechanics for that matter, we write down quantum mechanics problems which are not Gaussian in a Hilbert space defined by the Gaussian theory which dominates the high energy behavior. In field theories which don't have Gaussian fixed points, we can't do that. Those field theories are generally much harder to solve, but if we have a fixed point theory that we can solve exactly, we can do exactly the same thing and perturb it by relevant operators. So I would suggest that a strategy to pursue in studying M theory is to first solve the so-called trivially soluble theory of stable black holes, and then use that as a basis in which to formulate which operators we perturb by in order to construct all the different versions of M theory that we see, thinking of them as somehow relevant operators acting on the free black hole Hilbert space. These operators will make black holes interact, make them decay into gravitons, etc. And general relativity we might think of as the chiral low-energy Lagrangian for this perturbative QGD. Okay. I have a few minutes here to do something that I learned from one of my collaborators a little while ago. I learned that it's a good thing to get up at a time when you're working and you haven't yet understood a certain problem, but to get up at a conference and talk about it. And so here's a couple of words about a problem that Willy Fischler and Lubos Motl and I are thinking about, which is to try to understand a little bit more about black hole structure and black hole entropy. And this follows some very deep but ignored work by Betuft that was presented at the Strings Conference in 97, and that in itself comes after an earlier paper by Page and Zurich. So I want you to think briefly about the near horizon region looked at by a static observer in Schwarzschild coordinates of a generic horizon, meaning not an extremal horizon, one that is Schwarzschild-like. It looks like Rindler space, and then there's a transverse sphere. And if I think about, I can always expand things on the transverse sphere and rewrite everything as a whole bunch of 1 plus 1 dimensional fields. And when I think about what's going on as I go near the horizon, there's a famous infinite redshift and the famous fact that the Schwarzschild observer sees things that fall into the horizon being squeezed to very short distances near the horizon. And we think of that as taking a sort of UV limit of the 1 plus 1 dimensional physics. And it's very hard to understand how to actually start from your long distance physics and crank it up and get to that UV limit. But we also understand quite in general that UV limits very often lead us to conformal field theories. And so it's very suggestive that the physics near the horizon of a Rindler space should be described by some sort of 1 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theory coupled to gravity in the 2 dimensional space and to this field R which describes the transverse area of the spheres. Now, effectively, what was done in these papers by Atuft and Page and Zurich was to show in 4 dimensions, and I believe we've generalized that to general d-dimensional black holes, that if you make a model like that of physics near the horizon as described by gravity with these degrees of freedom coupled to a 1 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theory, that you actually calculate correctly the entropy of the black hole, including the exact factor of 1/4. It works only for this equation of state, for the matter. We think that this argument gives us some idea why that should be the right equation of state. And we're working hard to try to see whether we can generalize this and understand it a little better. And I hope my collaborators will forgive me for talking about it a little too early. So now, we've come to the gates of Paradiso. If you remember the poem, at the gates of paradise, Virgil, who was born before the birth of Christ, was not allowed in. And the virtuous pagan Virgil must leave you now, but soon Beatrice will appear to lead DG to the garden of M-theory, where all truth and wisdom will be revealed, and a prize beyond price will be awarded. Happy birthday, David. May I be seen. Indeed. So that's the problem of hadronization. Okay. Just as in QCD, you can calculate some well, you can probably calculate the total cross section just from the thermal formula, right? If you know, I think you have to know the spectrum of massless particles. Basically, we're doing this, thinking of doing this at arbitrarily high energies. So the temperature is going to zero. Everything that's going to come out will be the massless particle. So you do have to know that. But that's a hard thing to do, right? But I would think of that as you're saying that there were some things that we could just do absolutely without knowing anything about the final states. And I guess that probably the analogy can't be pushed quite that far. At least at the moment, I don't see how to do it. Leonardo, Leopardo, whatever your name was. Excuse me? I've certainly thought about that very hard. And I have some vague ideas about it, but it really would, I can talk to you privately, but it just wouldn't be, it doesn't make enough sense to say anything about it at this point.
So I guess I have a question about this idea of taking sort of very large black holes and sort of quantum theory on gravity. It seems that black holes are indistinguishable only in a classical approximation. The full exact quantum theory, there are lots of different states, right? And that's what gives rise to the entropy. And it's only when we coarse grain and look at just the gravitational field and lower the gravitational field.
I intend you to talk about all of those states. What I would mean by solving the theory, I think we know what the Hamiltonian looks like. So the really hard problem is sort of a problem in degenerate perturbation theory. We have to find a way to, depending on what the perturbation is, understand the Hilbert space of black hole states, which in the large mass approximation is just completely featureless, right? You give the energy of the black hole state, and there's this degenerate subspace. Unless you tell me what probes you're using from the outside, there's no way to distinguish one state in there from another. This is the exact asymptotics for m goes to infinity. So think of this like the Gaussian approximation to a quantum mechanics problem. All right? You think about the p squareds in the Hamiltonian. Okay. That's the part of the problem I'm talking about solving.
You're describing just the spectrum of black holes, right? Doesn't contain a piece that describes the scattering of black holes, which is also there for the large mass. But the Hamiltonian is much more complicated.
Well, it's not clear to me that if you want to calculate the S matrix for elementary particles, that you ever have to understand the scattering of large black holes. Okay, that, you know, the elementary particle properties would come out of this by putting in a single large black hole, letting it decay, and then look at the final state interactions in that decay, which would give you the S matrix for the elementary things that are coming out. I agree with you, the scattering of large black holes. I think that's also a problem we, in principle, know how to solve, but it's a very hard problem in numerical relativity that nobody has yet succeeded in doing. That's the second time you've asked me the question. I don't. Yeah, in Banff, we had the same discussion.
This is what happens when you turn
60. No. Only if you take drugs. Yes. If you recall, my reply to you there was, I've noted that connection. I don't understand it. Do you?
Okay. Well, on this note, more on your section, then.